Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Wednesday morning. It's April 15th, currently 35 degrees here in Old Town Park City under mostly sunny skies, 37 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Wednesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. As we go throughout your middle of the work week, we're looking at lots of sunshine, but expect a few high clouds to build in the afternoon hours. Today is definitely the pick day for the rest of the week here, as we're going to be looking at sunshine and warmer temperatures. We should see our high temperatures climbing into the mid-50s in Park City this afternoon. We'll be seeing those numbers climbing into the low 60s for us in the Heber Valley. As we go throughout tonight, we'll see those clouds increasing across the region once again. And as we move into your Thursday morning, we've got some big weather changes moving our way. Now, Thursday morning will likely start off with temperatures around 50 degrees in Park City, with temperatures in the mid to upper 50s in the Heber Valley. But a strong cold front will move through during the early morning hours on your Thursday. That will drop those temperatures down into the 30s by your Thursday afternoon. Along with that, it will bring a good chance of precipitation across the area. We're likely looking at the chance of snow off and on as we go throughout the day on your Thursday, both in Park City and in the Heber Valley, as those snow levels will quickly drop from the 7,500 feet range down to about 4,000 feet by the time we get into your Thursday afternoon. So there will be a chance of some accumulating snow as we go throughout your Thursday afternoon evening. And then as we get the wraparound moisture moving through Thursday night into Friday morning, I think that will provide the best chance of seeing some snow accumulations out there, both in Park City and into the Heber Valley. Overnight temperatures by Friday morning dipping down into the upper teens to lower 20s across the area. How much snow are we expecting? Well, for most of us in the Wasatch Back, we're looking at that potential of anywhere from 1 to 4 inches. But as you get over towards Park City and some of those higher mountain valleys, we're going to be talking about the potential of seeing anywhere from 4 to 7 inches of snow as that system makes its way through. So definitely a taste of winter heading our way over the next 48 hours or so. But the good news is we dry things out for the weekend, starting off cool, but warming up as we head into the weekend into next week. That's a good July's forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. Coming up this morning on the Local News Hour, I'll be checking in with Summit County Transportation Director Carl Miller with an update on some road and bridge projects. Also, Heber City Council member Sid Oskergar calling in with a recap from yesterday's meeting, and from Summit Community Gardens and Eats, Executive Director Helen Nadel with a preview of gardening season. Then stay tuned for The Mountain Life. Today's guests include allergist Dr. Zachary Rubin, who unpacks the science behind asthma, food allergies, and hay fever. Then therapist Jenna Free discusses her new book, The Simple Guide to ADHD Regulation, The Secret to Finding Balance, Getting Things Done, and Enjoying Your Life. All of that coming up in The Mountain Life, heard every Wednesday from 9 to 10. Summit County and the Utah Olympic Park have hammered out an agreement for the future of the park's development. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports that county council members may vote on that at its meeting today.
Summit County attached a redlined and updated version of the Utah Olympic Park Development Agreement to its April 15th council agenda. It changes the approval process for a 120-unit hotel from a conditional use permit to a low-impact permit. That means another public hearing is not required. The draft agreement says the county will also support the UOP's efforts to be designated as a, quote, major sporting event venue ahead of the 2034 Winter Olympic Games. State law allows such venues to form public infrastructure districts, which means the UOP could issue bonds like governments do. The agreement also defines how the UOP is allowed to use the back gate at the top of Bear Hollow Road in the Sun Peak neighborhood. After almost 2 hours of negotiation on April 1st, however, Councilmember Roger Armstrong says it's still unclear how much housing the development agreement will allow.
In a traffic study, Farron Pierce used 222 units as the measure under the 2025 plan that they put forward. And then when I asked the question, what came back was something closer to 100 new units.
The residential building already on the property includes 72 units for athletes and coaches. According to the development agreement's traffic study, the UOP was allowed to build a total of 141 dwellings in 2011, plus a winter sports school and office space. The traffic study for the new proposal imagined 222 dwellings, the hotel, a different mix of office space, and no school. Armstrong says the council is close to answering all its questions and expects the UOP to say more about the affordable housing question at the next meeting. County Manager Shane Scott could not say for sure if the council would vote April 15th.
I mean, I just never want to say that anymore. I just never know. I think so. I think we're poised to.
The vote has been pushed numerous times this year after Sun Peak residents raised concerns about various parts of the agreement. Residents around the Snyderville Basin worry about traffic since the council is also considering a proposal to redevelop the Junction Commons outlets with housing. That's in addition to the controversial Dakota Pacific project approved last year. Scott says the council has been meeting in Kimball Junction for most of this year to make it convenient for residents to attend discussions about UOP. Wednesday's meeting will be back in Colville, the county seat. Scott says that's because of items related to the North Summit Fire District. Summit County and the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation are financial supporters of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
In the studio now with an update on road and bridge projects this summer, I've got Summit County Transportation Director Carl Miller. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So traffic and transportation remain key issues for the county. Let's talk a little bit about the major transportation projects that drivers should be aware of in Summit County this year.
Sure. We have several things coming up, many things that are going to be transformational for the way that we get around the community. Obviously, the BOB, the Bus Rapid Transit route for High Valley Transit is going to be something that's been worked on for a number of years, and exciting to see that things are happening on that. And we're going to have construction has started, and you'll see that as you drive 224. But this project will really help to get people around in the community, provide opportunities and options for people to get to these major destinations. And so we're really excited to see the progress of the BOB.
Okay. And in addition, let's talk about some of the other projects that I know that we're working on, and that includes a bridge along State Route 32.
And let me first talk about, if it's all right, the bridge on Jeremy Ranch. UDOT is coming to council today to give an overview of that bridge project. Basically, those bridges are getting to the end of their expected life and need to be replaced. So there will be construction starting as soon as next month on that. That won't affect I-80 at first. Those will be, UDOT's using what's called accelerated bridge construction, where they're going to build the bridge next to the location and then kind of link it into place later on at the end of the project. It will affect the tunnel at Homestead Road, and so that will be constrained down to one lane and have, you know, some pinch points there. But overall, this project will help to extend the life of that location and to really help people to that project, the way that they're doing it will really lessen the impact on how we commute, in that they're going to just do that over the course of the year and a half, and then they'll drop those bridges in over the course of 2 weeks, but that won't be until 2027. So nothing that will impact us right now.
Okay, yeah, because that's, I think they have to like close at least parts of the highway or have some detour, right, so that they can get into the freeway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Those things won't occur until next year. The immediate pinch point is getting underneath the tunnel. And so expect some delays there. Everybody should know that. But replacing the bridge will be a major effort in 2027. We'll close down for probably two weekends. They'll time that and obviously communicate that out to the public well beforehand, so that way everybody's aware of that. But that will be a major redirection of that.
All right. Then let's jump to the bridge there along State Route 32.
I don't actually have a whole lot of information on that. The county engineers have been working with UDOT on that, and so I don't have any more information. I'll have to come back later with that.
Okay, and that's, again, something similar, though, just a bridge that needs to be replaced.
That's my understanding. Not as much of an impact on people. It won't require a complete takeout and we'll be able to redirect people and have less of an impact than the I-80 Jeremy Ranch bridges will.
Yeah, and so what is it? I mean, it's concrete. It just cold, wet, just kind of breaks it down eventually, huh?
Exactly. We just want to make sure that we're keeping our assets and maintaining those at a good life expectancy and replacing those so that they don't degrade over time. So that'll be an important maintenance feature that will just help us to keep the the construction under control and extend the life of that.
Okay. And what about the timeline for kind of finishing the roundabout on exit 2? Is that going to happen?
It is. We are really looking at that right now. We got the north side or the west side done. That is working great, very effectively, efficient traffic flow on that side. We're looking at the other side right now, and as we have, we've looked at that, a study to look at what would the traffic be in there. And how much would be able, that roundabout would be able to handle. We're really going through the design process right now and making sure that we have a good understanding of how long that roundabout would last. We don't want to build a roundabout for it only to last for a number of years. And so we're really looking at the full build out of that. And so we are going through the planning process with UDOT right now and designing that so that way we have a number of looking at options, but have extend that life so that way we're not redoing it ever just a couple more years.
Okay, so it sounds like that's still a few years off, or at least another year, huh?
At least another year off, yeah. We don't have it quite designed yet. We were at about 50% design, but we'll see. No construction will occur this year on that.
All right. The Snyderville Basin Cemetery District has published plans and diagrams showing a road connecting Olympic Parkway and Bear Cub Drive near Bear Hollow. They say that's a county road that or would be spearheaded by the county. Can you explain when that might be built?
Yeah, exactly. Olympic Parkway extension is in our long-range transportation plan, actually in phase one. It's a high, a critical piece of that network connection. As we're working with Cemetery District, we're really trying to find out what would be the best way to connect Olympic Parkway, both up to Olympic Park, or Utah Olympic Park, as well as potentially connecting with the neighborhood over there, so that way we have full connection and we have redundancy, so if there was a crash or an incident on the Olympic Parkway heading up to Utah Olympic Park, that we would have different ways to direct traffic. We can also use this as a catalyst for how are we going to serve Olympic traffic down the road and for 2034. And so we're really looking at that right now and working with the Cemetery District on how they're looking to identify a spot and then how would the corridor work with that, both with getting people to the cemetery as well as getting connections in that neighborhood.
Yeah. Any concern, though, about skiers or commuters maybe using these side roads to bypass 224?
Yes, exactly. And that's why we're going through this study. We'll be identifying how do we make sure that we're getting efficient throughput where we want that, but also not disrupting neighborhoods. And so that'll be a critical piece to make sure that we have considered all those things. We also have some topographical issues, some slopes, some wetlands. And so it's really a process where we want to make sure that we're looking at this thoroughly and making sure we've considered all the opinions.
Yeah. As you mentioned, it is in the county's long-range transportation plan. How certain is it that items in that plan actually get built?
Yeah, that's a great question. The plan really is to outline the vision and identify the projects that we want to see over the next several years. We're actually going to be updating that plan. We're working on that right now with our MPO down in Utah County, Mountain Lands Association of Government, and UDOT. We'll be working with some with them, and then we'll be doing some public outreach this fall to get some community input on that. And that will really outline what we want to be spending our resources and our funding on over the next 30 years, really. And so that'll be critical to get people's input and understand how they want the community to grow and what they want their transportation to look like. Just because it's on the plan doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen, especially right away. There's limited funds. And so we're really trying to make sure that we are prioritizing the projects that have the best return on investment, that really help the quality of life for the community. And so it's on the long-range transportation plan. We really want to get that done, but we're also limited in just the amount of projects we can work on.
Yeah. So do you expect that transportation plan, though, to be updated this year, or?
A lot of the work that is going on to it right now, identifying projects, doing all the analysis of what these projects would do as far as helping efficiency, congestion, quality of life, active transportation options, those kind of things. We'll do a public outreach this fall, and then we'll actually finalize the plan in 2027.
All right. As you know, traffic at Kimball Junction, a consistent concern. Any idea about a timeline for the work that will be done on 224 as a result of the Dakota Pacific negotiations?
Yeah, we're actually looking to get, UDOT is working on the left turns at Ute this summer. That will just be a partial of what will eventually be constructed there. The Kimball Junction interchange, as you know, the UDOT identified alternative C for their preference. They've added $50 million into what they call the statewide improvement transportation program. And those are scheduled for 2030. UDOT staff and county staff are working to accelerate that timeline. I wouldn't be surprised if the Utah Transportation Commission moved that up, just because they are aware of the needs that we have both there now, currently, as well as getting that project done well before the Olympics. So we are looking to get that moved up on the STIP. Again, I wouldn't be surprised if it was moved a year or two earlier, but no guarantees at this point.
Sure. So, I mean, what would change with the Kimball Junction Interchange? That was built for the 2002 Olympic Games.
Yeah, so basically it would add lanes for exiting off of I-80. It would add capacity lanes on both northbound and southbound. And then one of the key parts of this would add a pedestrian crossing where the Richens building is right now over to Redstone. And that would really be the main access for pedestrians to get back and forth across the corridor. And we're really excited about that, because right now pedestrians have to cross several lanes of traffic. It's very dangerous. And it's really not a very comfortable or safe way to get around the community. So we're working right now with UDOT. They've recently hired their designers on that. And so we're working the pedestrian crossing in with the rest of the Kimball Junction interchange design so that that can be a key component and really bring people into the community better.
Okay, so this won't be done until the BRT project is completed, it sounds like. Yeah,
that's what it's looking like. Yeah.
Yeah. How closely do you work with High Valley Transit? I mean, I guess what's the county's role in regional transit solutions?
Yeah, High Valley Transit does a great job with transit planning and providing those services to the community. The county is working with them, and we work really closely to make sure that transit, as well as other modes of transportation, are well integrated, so that way we can, make sure that transit and active transportation and congestion management is done collaboratively, and really make sure that we're looking at these things comprehensively. So while they do a great job with transit, we're really helping to integrate those modes of travel across, so that way we're looking at this as one complete piece.
Okay, and what can you tell us about the rollout plans for the Summit Bike Share? That's the county's e-bike ride program.
We're hoping to roll that out on May 1st is the expected launch date. That might get bumped a little bit. Over the off season, we did a lot of work, and we contracted with a new software provider, and so we're really excited about that. We've heard complaints in the past that the app was clunky or that people couldn't use it, and so we believe that this new software will be much better. People will be able to check out bikes easier and faster. They will need to re-download the app to get the bikes. But along with that, we're also getting a new fleet of bikes. These bikes will be lighter, more nimble, just easier to get around. And one thing that we're really excited about is with these new bikes, we won't have to have the same stations configuration. So we'll have what we can call our light stations. They're not required the same capital expense to put those in. They don't require electrical power, because these bikes have much better batteries. And so we're really looking to get these out into the communities. And so if there's businesses or neighborhoods that are looking for these light stations, it will really help us to get stations throughout the community, so that everybody has a bike share station within a reasonable walk of wherever they work or wherever they live. And that's one of the really exciting things we have launching this season. One other aspect we're really excited about is we're going to have an access pass, which will really be designed for income qualifying individuals, so that everybody can have access to the bikes and get around, especially those that need them the most.
All right, so when do you expect to have that software update?
Yeah, we're putting on the final touches on that right now. So we're still expecting a May 1st launch, and that new website, new app will be ready for that May 1st launch. But Leslie, as you know, things might get, as we get down to the final touchdown point on that, it might get delayed by a few days, but we're looking at still at an early May launch.
Oh, okay. And in terms of, I mean, do the old bikes, are you going to continue to use them? So you're going to have more bikes, or do you try and sell those, the older ones somewhere?
Great question. Yeah, we'll have a mixed fleet for a while. We are looking and very aggressively trying to find funding for adding these new bikes. I think people will really like these. They're lighter and just easier to get around on. However, we want to make sure that we have the old bikes as well, so that way we have sufficient bikes out in the community. So for now, riders will get to choose between the traditional bikes and the new bikes until we get it to the point where we have all new fleet.
All right. So are they still speed limit kind of locked in?
Exactly. They're all electric assist, which is great for getting around. But they will be controlled so that they will not exceed 15 miles per hour. And then we can either add throttle controls in certain areas so that way there's, not a dangerous situation. So we really think that these are a great addition to the community.
All right. Any new locations then?
We're working with a few businesses to add new locations. Studio Crossing is looking to get one out there, and I think that'll be great for getting people across the 248 to the hospital, where I know that a lot of their employees or their residents will work out. But also, it's not too far to the city and Old Town from on the electric bikes on the rail trail. So that'll be a great addition. We're working with a couple others. Still need to sign license agreements and everything like that. But really, our goal is to get a station within 800 feet of every major location in the community so that everybody has access to getting those bikes.
Wonderful. So how big is the fleet now?
It's about 250 bikes. We've had to decommission a few bikes that were getting cracked. We inherited a system where we had bikes that had been used for a number of years, and we just want to make sure that we're really capitalizing on safety first. We don't want to put bikes out on the community that are not ready for use, and so we have decommissioned several bikes during the off-season, but we've added, I think, just as many with these new bikes.
Okay. Anything else, Carl, you wanted to mention?
No, thank you for having me.
All right. Carl Miller is Summit County Transportation Director. Thanks for your time. Last night in a special meeting, Heber City Council voted 4-2 to extend City Manager Matt Brower's contract for another 3 years. On the phone with an update on that and other issues, I have Council Member Sid Ostergaard. Good morning, Sid. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so the meeting was delayed until 9 o'clock last night because the council spent 3 hours in a closed session discussing Brower's performance. Why did that take so long?
So, Leslie, good question. And the reason is unfortunately, the city doesn't have a means to evaluate, a process to evaluate our city manager. And because of that, we had to, start one, and we have one now, and it took longer just because of the evaluation that we needed to have and have that with Matt in the room. So it was just a lot of good discussion. It was hard discussion, but it was really good discussion. And I think from now on, and it's not perfect, the evaluation method, but it is there, and we'll refine it. And from now on, when this comes up again, we'll have some in place that we can use.
So was the city manager in the closed session with the council?
He was brought in to answer questions that council members had. So, yeah,
okay.
At the end.
All right.
So, and that's why it took a little bit longer, just so we could, get questions answered.
All right. Mayor Heidi Franco and Council Member Yvonne Barney voted against the contract, saying they had seen some concerns. I question about the mayor. Here in Park City, the mayor doesn't vote unless it's a tie vote. So why is the mayor allowed to vote?
So that's just in our city ordinances that the mayor has the ability to vote on this matter.
Only for city manager contracts or for all issues that come before the council?
Yeah, no, on city contract. And don't quote me on that. I'm not totally into it. That's where I lean on our city attorney and somebody smarter. But in this case, that's what was why we had the mayor a part of the vote.
All right. Concerning, there are concerns. What kind of things are they worried about, and how will the council address those going forward?
So I can't discuss a lot of them just because it's closed session, and they will come out and there'll be answers. Matt was very thorough in answering questions that we had, and he even gave us reports on histories of everything that was of question, that we questioned. So we have a book, we have homework to do that we need to dive in and come circle back around and ask those questions with Matt.
All right. Dozens of people attended the meeting. Many more wrote in to share their comments. Any idea how many comments the council received?
Too many. It was good. And with that, you know, Aaron Cheatwood and Morgan and even Yvonne thanked for public input. This is the process. We have to have public input. And it came from the public and from city staff, which was great because that is needed for, well, we need that input as a council to make the right decision for the better of the Heber City.
Yeah. What did most of the comments say?
It was a mixture, but I'm going to highlight one, and it was city staff. Very positive, very positive. Yeah, there might be some that didn't come forward, but you think about what Matt has to do with his staff and what's going on in the city. We're growing so fast and we're understaffed. So I'm just going to say we have amazing staff, oh my word. Our staff is crazy good, very responsive to the needs of the Heber citizens and to us as council. So from their point of view, very positive comments on that.
Okay, so who was absent last night then?
Who was absent?
Absent, yeah. I mean, we should see a vote 4-2, 6. Oh, yeah, okay, never mind. My math was wrong. Okay.
You're scaring me, Leslie.
Yeah. Hey, what do you value most? You vote. What do you value most, I should say, in a city manager?
I value his planning. So city managers, I've worked with plenty throughout my career, and I understand city managers, they're certain ones that just react, right? If there's a problem, that's what they do. They react. What Matt has is a vision, and you can see it. And that's one of the reasons why I decided to get into this. Leslie, I'm not a politician, but I'm very invested in Heber City and trying to make it better. And I saw Matt's vision, and I wanted to be a part of that. So,
yeah. As you know, there was a lot of anger in the room last night among members of the public. I mean, there were angry outbursts with the police chief even asking people to leave. Councilmember Barney mentioned that there was also a lot of concerning behavior online, including threatening comments about Matt Brower and some members of the council. So why is there so much division in the community?
That's a good question. You know, in a growing city like this, as the Wasatch Back grows, people move there for a reason. And things are not going, or when they move there, they had a vision of what it is. Now the vision is different. It's not worse. It's just different. And, you know, there is that division right there. And social media, as you know, it's the worst thing out there. You look at it in any from the government level down to the cities and counties, it's out there. And me personally, I don't listen to that noise. I listen to people that really want to do good and really want something good for the community in Heber City.
So what do you do to kind of lower the temperature here?
One of the things that came out, we need to be more transparent. I totally agree. We do. And we always say that. And how do we do that? we just have to be upfront with people. We have to get them more informed somehow, and that's what council's going to have to work on. And Matt, as a city manager, we're just going to have to be a lot more transparent and upfront with the public. Yeah, you're going to have the naysayers that are you can't change, but, you know, as long as we're trying to do that, in my opinion, that's a win.
All right. Moving on, one issue I know you care deeply about is affordable housing.
Yes.
Share the latest on the Celebration development. This is the project plan near the high school.
So the Celebration Watts development is doing it. It is affordable housing for rent project that they are trying to provide housing for the school district, IHC. He's in talks with both the school district and IHC. He presented in front of the school board a little while back, and he is trying to provide places for people, the essential workers, to live, because it is, as we know, it's a crisis. Affordable housing is a crisis in the Wasatch Back, in Utah, and even in the country. So he's just one part of what we're trying to do in Heber City. With the help of Jason Glinton from Mountain Lands Community Housing Trust, we are going to have what's called Affordable Housing 101. This is where we're going to invite special guests, people that understand affordable housing, with Jason, to educate council on how and what to do to achieve, you know, help with this crisis. I'm so excited about it, Leslie. This is my passion. It is truly a needed thing. And in the Wasatch Back, we all have to work together. Cities, counties, school districts have to work together to solve this problem. It's not easy. If it was easy, it would be done by now. But
the council also recently discussed whether to change the owner occupancy requirements for old mill townhomes. This is a development that does have an income restriction. What's your opinion here? I mean, should you allow owners, shouldn't you, I should say, require owners to occupy affordable housing? Why wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's a touchy subject, and we see the reasoning why they're doing that. But yeah, I'm with you, Leslie. We need to have people. We need people to own houses and be a part of the community. That's what creates a great community.
So what's your opinion here? Is this going to be allowed?
We are still in negotiations. We haven't came up with a final decision. It's still in negotiations. And there could be, we might give them, you know, a little bit just to help them, you know, progress the development along. But in the overall, I would rather have 100% owner occupied.
Okay. You've spoken in the past about making some changes to how the Wasatch County Housing Authority operates. Where do those ideas stand?
So, you know, I'm a part of that, and it is hard having so many things draw you away from that important job. And we're trying to figure out if it's needed an executive director of that to help. That's their job, is to help facilitate that. Right now, currently, Mountain Lands Community Housing Trust is our kind of consultant to help facilitate and make sure the affordable housing projects and, you know, from rental to ownership are happening. But it would be worth to have a director that's their job. And that's all they're doing is out there, because we need somebody there full time helping with that.
All right. You've also floated the idea of hiring a full-time housing director. I mean, is that something then that you want to add to the city's budget conversation this summer?
It is discussion, and we don't know how it's going to happen. There is talk. Kendall Crittenden's the chair of that. And he suggested, this is county. Maybe the county is the ones that are going to help fund it. So, again, it's still in negotiations, and we're still talking about it.
Okay. Any other affordable projects in the works that the community should know about?
There are, and we are getting a lot of people, developers, great developers coming and asking, how can we help? We meet with them and talk how we can help them help us, you know, provide that housing there. So, in fact, we met with Tony, myself, and Jason met with a group called Rocky Mountain Homes Fund. And I've never heard of this, and they've been around forever. They're an entity that helps people be able to get into housing. I don't know all the details of that. And we're going to invite them to come and explain their strategies and how they do it in our Affordable Housing 101.
Okay. Moving on, tonight's an interlocal meeting with Wasatch County and Midway. You're trying out a new symposium format. Why the change?
I think we're just trying everything. We're trying to keep, you know, as current as we can. And if that works, that's, you know, that's for the better. So.
Well, in the past, that interlocal meeting has kind of been a casual roundtable discussion where leaders brainstorm and then go back and forth. So under this new format, will those less structured policy discussions be happening behind the scenes instead?
They could. We'll see how it happens, how it goes. I don't know for sure if this is the right format. I enjoy where we sit around and just talk about the issues and see how we can help each other and work together. So in my opinion, I love that a lot, just that interface, face-to-face, and let's roll up our sleeves and get to work.
All right, well, tonight's agenda includes planning for the 2034 Olympics, open space preservation, and land use policy. How will Heber City leaders be participating?
We'll be listening in. Definitely we'll be aware of what's going on. It is between Midway and the county, so yeah. We always, you know, it is the valley, and all of us have to work together.
Any other issues you think local government needs to collaborate on?
Not the big one right now in my forefront is this affordable housing. That is a huge thing that we need to address, and we need to do it sooner than later. So I'm pushing for that, Leslie. It is my priority.
Okay, Sid, I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That's Heber City Council member Sid Ostergaard. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. In the studio now with an update from Summit Community Gardens and Eats is Executive Director Helen Nadel. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. It's great to see you again.
Yeah, so you'll be on each month with an update at the garden. Start by just telling us the mission of your organization.
Sure. Well, first, can I just wish everybody a slightly belated Happy National Gardening Day. That was yesterday. And I wanted to just share with everybody a little bit about what we do and why we do it. Summit Community Gardens and Eats is all about building community through food. People learn, grow, and gather, and food really does connect everyone. And that's kind of what we are trying to do at the garden and at the school programs that we run. All school year, we lead food education that connects kids to where food comes from. All year long, we lead food access programs that really focus on fruits and vegetables. And now, May through October, the community garden is open for our entire community. We provide a space for anyone who wants to grow their own food, as well as to gather for programs, for education, and just to enjoy a beautiful space. It is available to anybody. There's a gate, but that's really for animals. People are welcome anytime to come in and stroll.
Okay, so do you have any plots available for this summer growing season?
You know, I can tell you that as of Monday, we are actually sold out of plots, which is exciting. It's cool to see, you know, people's interest in connecting to food and growing food. It's a very empowering thing to do, to grow your own food, especially up here in a climate where it's, you know, has its challenges. Doing it in community is really awesome. What I can say, though, is there is a wait list, and we always find that there are folks who, for whatever reason, you know, back in November, December, December, thought they'd be able to garden with us and can't. So hop on the wait list right on our website, and those will certainly start to open up. We typically have a, you know, 3, 5, 7 that will open up, you know, in June or July, early July.
Okay. So how do the gardens look? Lots of weeds?
You know, there's a couple weeds here and there. But I would say it's, you know, this is, it's both, I mean, this spring has been a little wacky, hasn't it? It's been there's been a lot going on. There's definitely, you know, some weeds that are popping up. And we definitely encourage, I mean, for both home gardeners and for community gardeners, now is a great time to do a few things. One is weed, of course, always a good time to weed. But second, it is a really great time to work on your soil. Right now, you know, what I've found last year myself is that amending soil, so adding things to the soil like compost, nitrogen, always a great thing to add a little bit to the soil, and organic blood meal, putting those into to your gardening space 1 to 2 inches deep, kind of working that into the soil, that creates such an incredible environment for healthy plants. So whatever you're growing, whether it's food, whether it's flowers, it's a great thing to do now. Because what I can tell you is what's not such a great thing to do right now is to actually plant seeds. It is, as we know, this weather, the weather the entire season, but especially right now, our spring has been really, really unpredictable. We've got, you know, snow, freezing temps coming in. This is not germination weather, so it's not a great time to get seeds in the ground. Great time to weed, great time to work your soil, and also a good time just to order seeds to kind of dream a little bit about what you'd like to plant when it's planting time.
Yeah, I mean, there are some cold crops, so when can those start going
in?
You know, the lettuces and the chards and things like that.
Exactly. Yeah, so our recommendation is first week of May is when you can get those cold weather crops. And I know a lot of people have been really excited to get those in the ground, you know, starting when we had those temperatures in the 70s back in mid-March. But really waiting patiently until the first week of March. The crops that are going to go in first, like you said, the cold weather crops, the hardy crops that really thrive in the cold weather. So things like peas, radishes, spinach, lettuce. One way to think about it is anything that is a root or a leaf does really well in cold weather. Those plus peas. For the hot crops, things like tomatoes, peppers, eggplants. I see you smiling there, Leslie. Everybody's favorites, right?
Don't do it.
Don't do it. Wait, please wait until June. Mid-June is really a good time where we, you know, the worst of the frosts are really behind us. Of course, always keep an eye out for those lower temps because you'll want to cover some of those sensitive crops. We know last year we had a frost in June and we had frosts in August as well. So those are recommendations.
Okay, looking ahead to the rest of the community garden season, you've got lots coming up. Children's camps.
Yeah, our garden camp is really kind of a beloved institution. Kids get outdoors, they explore, they're in the natural world, there's discovering. And our really the hallmark of our program is really, you know, like our school programs, it's connecting kids to how food grows. And I think that, you know, the garden camp provides, you know, a week-long opportunity. We have 9 one-week sessions. All of them focus on gardening, on tending plants, and on perhaps most fun, harvesting and cooking with them. So every single week, lots and lots of cooking, lots of tasting, and lots of, cooking simple recipes.
So are those the summer camps or are those the after-school camps?
Those are the summer camps. Mm. Yeah, those are summer camps. Those start June 8th this year, so week right after school ends. We are jumping right into garden camp. I want to just mention there are, we have about 40 young people who are already attending on scholarship. Last year, about 22% of kids attended on full scholarship, and we are really looking to do the same again this year. It's great to have our entire community present at garden camp and having fun together. So there are still some scholarships available for those, and there also are some spots available. Preschool camp, a lot of those are sold out. Some of our elementary school camps are sold out, but we do still have some availability, especially for elementary. And what I would also say is here, the wait list again, wait list is really important. We constantly have things opening up, whether it's, you know, families changing plans or, you know, needing to swap a week. So if you put yourself on the wait list, either for scholarships or for regular price camps, those may open up. So please go ahead and do that. And we just, the garden camp is really a special time in the garden. We love having the garden, the community garden, filled with kiddos learning and exploring and having fun.
Okay, you've got dinners in the garden, dates, they are on the calendar, but tickets aren't available yet.
Correct, yeah. We are still working on dates. We're still working on chefs. We do have the dates available. So June 25th, July 9th, July 24th for our annual pie and beer celebration. That's a big one. And then August 6th and August 20th. We do have a couple chefs pinned down, and then we have a couple of chefs where we're still talking to about, you know, who will exactly be going when. But, you know, in past years, we've had Twisted Fern, we've had Hearth and Hill, we've had Nosh, we've had some wonderful folks. Our, you know, pie and beer night, we always have incredible support from some of the local restaurants serving pizza, and of course Auntie M's as well. So those are great. Those will open up to the public May 18th. And then if you are interested, if you know you love these, or you've heard about them and really want to go, we are opening registration early for our Friends of the Garden. And the Friends of the Garden program is really, it provides early access to things like registration to camp, registration to garden dinners, but also just as a way for people who support the work that we do year round to help us make everything happen year round.
Okay, and I'm guessing the food pharmacy program returns?
Yeah, so the food pharmacy, our food access programs actually operate year round. So during the year, we provide fruit to schools. So about 6,500 pounds of fruit and vegetables to school children in our district. And that's through the school outreach coordinators who really know the families best. And we also run the food pharmacy year round. Now during, you know, from November, starting in November until early June, we are actually purchasing that food. So those fruits and vegetables that go out every other week to 32 families who are experiencing food insecurity and chronic disease. And then starting in June, we'll be harvesting that food and, providing a range of fabulous fruits and vegetables to folks through October.
Okay, and then the La Milpa program also returning. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so La Milpa is a really very special initiative that we have at the garden. We host La Milpa gatherings and growing methods at the community garden with Artes de Mexico, which is a really amazing partner based in Salt Lake. If folks don't know Artes de Mexico, check them out. What that program is all about is honoring indigenous knowledge. So highlighting both cultural identity and Maya growing practices. In the 4 years that we've been running this program in the garden, people with Maya roots in our community have been growing corn, beans, and squash, and other culturally relevant crops, helped to conserve customs, past and present, and really provided a welcoming space for community education and community connection. And, you know, I think most importantly, fostered a deep connection to the land on which the community garden sits. I think, you know, one of the things that's really powerful about the community garden is the sense of place and land nestled right under the mountains, and a place that's been, cherished for such a long time.
Okay. Anything else?
I guess the only other thing I'll just say is that there are lots and lots and lots of ways to get involved with Summit Community Gardens and Eats. Last year, 300 volunteers provided 1,000 hours, and starting on May 7th, we'll have 2 to 3 openings for people who maybe don't want to plot or don't have space to garden in their homes, but really, really either miss gardening or just really want to get their hands in the soil. So please look on the website for that under volunteering. And we continue to need folks to help deliver food. So, you know, through June, the first week of June, we need folks on Mondays to deliver fruit and vegetables to our schools. And then the Christian Center delivers the food pharmacy food every other Thursday. You can sign up through their website all year. So want to just mention that and say thank you so much, Leslie, for the opportunity.
Okay. Helen Nadel is Executive Director of Summit Community Gardens and Eats. Thanks. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.